Hello, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith. The most important thing that I can share with you is that it hadn't been necessary for me to take a drink or do any drugs since May the 11th, 1976. And for that, I'm especially grateful. I'm glad to be here. And I'm glad to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can't think of any place that I would rather be than in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, to tell you the truth. And if you're new or relatively new and you don't feel that way, why, I understand that. If you've been here for a while and you don't feel that way, I understand that. I've experienced all those feelings. You know, I like to see the countdown. I always think it's really interesting to watch different lengths of sobriety and what have you. Always points out the fact that there's big gaps up at the top, I don't intellectualize any of those kind of things, but I understand that too. because out of my graduation class, I'm sober a little over 21 years, and out of my graduation class, I'm the only one that still sober. See, a lot of them are dead. Out of 39 of us that started out together, detox together, there's 39 of us started out, and I'm the only one that's still sober out of that. And there's several of them who committed suicide sober because sobriety was too rough. There were several of them that committed suicide drunk. There was a couple of them committed suicide by accident. Alcoholics do those kinds of things, I don't say that to have some kind of morbid reflection. I think I never forget those kind of people. I know the people that literally gave their life to prove that what I'm doing is right. They literally gave their life to prove that what I'm doing is right. For every year I've been sober, over 21 now, going on 22. There's been somebody that I met and talked to in Alcoholics Anonymous and worked the steps with, who, I shared what I have to do to stay sober, what I went through, what happened, what it's like today, my experience, strength, and hope. And they'd say, well, that's great for you, but I don't have to do that. I don't want to do that, or I don't need to do that. And consequently, they would go drink again or use again and die. For every year I've been sober, there's been somebody who I've intimately been involved with Alcoholics Anonymous, who literally died as a result of this disease. It's a terminal disease, which means somebody has to die. And I don't ever forget those people. I really don't. That's a form of prayer for me to even mention that, because they literally gave their life to prove that what I'm doing is right. And they didn't make a mistake and die because of it or any kind of a thing like that. They literally gave their life to prove that what I'm doing is right. That's the difference. And I think that's one of the simplest forms of prayer that I can offer up, is for the simple willingness for me to be able to do what I got to do in order to stay sober. And not base that on the fact that, I got to do what you do in order to stay sober. I've been sober long enough to know that I got to do what I got to do in order to stay sober. And that's a real transition, and I think that's one of the interesting things when you look at get an opportunity like this group here tonight and see the different lengths of sobriety, all the way from 34 years, and the next one's 24, and the next one's 21, it's me. I remember sitting in my home group, and when I first went to my home group, 46 years old, and I was sitting in my home group, and there was guys in there with 29 years of sobriety, 26, 24, 22, 21, several of them 18. And by the time I was somewhere between 7 and 9 years sober, I was the old timer in that group. I remember sitting in there one night and looking around. Out of 70 people, I was looking around and I was sober the longest in that meeting. It was a scary thought. It was a scary thought because, I didn't realize the responsibility for that. I didn't realize the responsibility. And you know what I'm getting at is that I know what it's like to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and use Alcoholics Anonymous to sober up. And then come back after drinking and use Alcoholics Anonymous to sober up. And then come back and then use Alcoholics Anonymous to sober up. And the difference is today is that on May the 11th, 1976, I had my first sober day. And from that point until tonight, this minute, standing here right now, I've used Alcoholics Anonymous to stay sober, not just to sober up. There was some, if there's an invisible line that I crossed over there in my drinking, going in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, somewhere there, I crossed over an invisible line, a surrender, as a result of my drinking, as a result of not doing what I gotta do in Alcoholics Anonymous, I crossed over an invisible line somewhere, I couldn't tell you where it was. When I look back on it, and I've inventoried a lot, somewhere inside of me, I made a decision, a commitment, a prayer, all of the above, to do whatever is necessary to do to stay sober. Bar none. And I've been doing that ever since. See? Now that's somewhat along the lines of what you got here in this room. I mean, you got a room that'll seat 1,000 people or whatever, I guess, if you jammed them in here, and you got 100 or so. You know, and there's lots of people in this town, in this area, that need to be here tonight. Some of them know about it, some of them don't. Some of them don't care, whatever, you know. There may be in other meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. But, you know, what is the commitment that you make in order to, you know, stay sober? And, you know, that's, that can, you know, it's, sometimes it's based on the fact that I think, well, what was my commitment to get drunk? You know, I hear people say, well, did you drink when it rained? Yes. Well, then you go to an AA meeting when it rained. You know, they'd say all kinds of reference points about what do you do to stay sober in comparison to what you did to get a drink. You know, I mean, I got on an airplane and flew up here from L.A., and it took a couple of 3 hours, you know, in order to get over here. And, you know, I've flown to San Francisco to get loaded. You know, I went to Saudi Arabia to get loaded. In a place that they'll kill you if you drink. So, you know, I mean, it's, I can't compare, say, well, how far would I drive to buy a bag of weed, you know? And I don't even like weed, you know? I bought a bag of weed to sell, not to smoke, you know? So I don't know. it's just that, you know, when I look back on my life and I look at a very early age, I started drinking and, you know, I mean, I don't know if I was born an alcoholic or not. It really doesn't make any difference. I know when I took a drink, an alcoholic was born. And I immediately set up a phenomenon of craving. And I, you know, I did, looking back on it, I didn't just, I was a guzzler from the get-go. I know that, you know, I mean, I wanted it all because I knew, you know, I wasn't supposed to have it. So greed and gluttony and all those things were, you know, enhanced the way that I drank at a very early age. And then I got the effect of it. And therefore, then I drank for the effect of that. And the effect that alcohol had on me changed over my life, my drinking career. I drank for 22 years. And so my drinking changed. That's why we have Chapter 3. I look back on my life, you know, and if there's certain character defects that I had that... It seemed as though when I put alcohol on top of those character defects, some of them had opened the door. You know? It opened the door and it could just rush out and do whatever it wants without any conscience. Men and women drink for the effect. The effect is after some amount of consumption, you can't distinguish the difference between true and false, right or wrong. That effect, what is that effect? That effect on me allowed me to do whatever I wanted to do and not have any guilt as long as I had the alcohol in me. That's also the definition of a sociopath, which is really kind of what I wanted to be. I overshot the mark there. If I I crossed over in an invisible line and dropped into a sociopathic behavior and psychopathic behavior and got that down real good, you know. I could lie. I could cheat and steal. I mean, lying was, it just went right along with it. I think I was a better liar than I was a drinker in the very beginning, and then later I had to lie better and because of my drinking. And then it turned on, both of them turned on me, and I couldn't lie and I couldn't drink, you know. And, I mean, I could call my wife up from 2,000 miles away, and she'd say, "You're drunk." And I think, "My God, who's watching me?" You know? And you know, I'd say, "How do you know I'm drunk? I'm 2,000 miles away." She said, "Because you ain't supposed to be 2,000 miles away." Yeah. "You're supposed to be home, dummy." You know? And, oh yeah. Forgot that, you know. And the amazing thing about that is that, I drank, anything I could drink. I grew up in Texas, and I grew up in an area where the Baptists bought all the liquor licenses, so it was dry, county option. And we had bootleggers, but mostly we had a lot of moonshine, white lightning. Oh, man, I mean, that stuff smelled bad, it tastes bad, it did bad things to you. The combinations of it is like drinking white gasoline. I remember one time a guy was fixing his lawnmower, and he had a fruit jar there full of white gasoline, and white gasoline's got those little things that float in it, and there was a quart jar of moonshine over there, and you couldn't tell the difference. You couldn't even tell the difference when you tasted it, you know. And, you know, said, "Don't drink that, that'll kill you." I said, "Oh yeah, well what'll this do to you, you know?" And, you know, I grew up on that kind of stuff. Amazing thing about it is I come from a whole line of alcoholics. I come from a family that's riddled with alcoholism. I was reading in the big book the other night at a book study, and it was talking about, you know, how alcoholism affects the family. And, the more it affects the family, you don't even have to drink. Families don't even have to drink. It affects the people around us. I mean, just drives them crazy. They just get crazy. And I was thinking about that, you know, if you're one person and you live with one person, and like an Al-Anon or pre-Al-Anon, and that drunk's driving this pre-Al-Anon crazy, how crazy can you get if you got 10 people drinking? And that's about what I had when I was growing up as a kid. I had about 10 people around me drinking. So all the neurotic behavior and the fears and all the paranoia and all the, and they were all different kinds of alcoholics. That's why we got stories in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. This is, so you can see there's all different kinds of alcoholics. My family had all kinds of alcoholics. With the exception of one, they had, two. My granddad said, there's two things that never been in my family. Never been a bootlegger or a whore. And when he said that, he just looked in the trunk of my car and I had a whole mess of whiskey in there that I was selling. So I was bootlegging. And I said, well, if I'd have been a woman, there'd have been a whore in the family. You know, I mean, it's just, we're not going to disgrace the family name, even though he just dropped my grandmother off at the school and drove into the front of the building, you know, drunk. But, you know, it was snowing and the brakes didn't work, you know. It wasn't because he was drinking Everclear and Kool-Aid, you know. My grandpappy drank Everclear and Kool-Aid, 190 proof vodka and Kool-Aid. If you ain't tried that, I'm going to tell you, you do that for effect. You don't do that for the taste. And I drank that kind of stuff, and sometimes I'd be a scared little kid, but I look back on my life and fear has been an integral part of my life from the very beginning. I don't think you can grow up in an alcoholic, neurotic, insane environment and not have fear. The thing I know today is, but from my inventory, is that fear affected me a certain way, and it affects people basically two different ways. Been my experience listening to a lot of fifth steps is that fear will either demobilize you or it'll mobilize you. It'll either, and not necessarily do you do it all the time one way. Some people do. Some people become inward and an introvert, and fear demobilizes them. They hunker down and hide. And other people, fear is an accelerator. some of the greatest war heroes that have in the history of time. Once they did some great thing. Audie Murphy was a drunk. Audie Murphy, godfather, lived in my hometown, and I remember when he came after the war, he talked to him about how all of his fantastic things that he did, and he said, "I was scared. I just ran. You know, I ran a bullet. Lucky, whatever." He didn't set out to do that. He was scared, and whenever things happened, he ran. He moved, and that's the way I was. When fear came in, I moved. I went someplace. Right or left, up, down, didn't make any difference. I went someplace. And so alcohol was an accelerator for me. And consequently, it didn't really make any difference whether I was drinking beer or whether I was drinking White Lightning. It had the same effect on me. And I went places and did things. And by the time I was 12 years old, they had me locked up with a bunch of kids that were trouble kids, you know, broken families, busted homes. Some of them were a little mental, you know, and they locked us up inside of a place that had a huge barbed wire fence around it, and in dormitories there was no women there, it was all men, all guys from the fourth grade to the senior in high school age. Back in Texas and that part of the country, they didn't call it a reformatory or anything like that, but it was just... It's just one of them places, you know, kind of like years and years ago whenever somebody had alcoholism, they'd lock them up in a nut ward. You know, that's all they had. And when I was a kid, for troubled kids, they had places where they put these troubled kids and they locked them up and they didn't really have a name for it. He's gone. You know, and everybody's glad, you know. And I ended up locked up there. And I spent almost 4 years in that environment. Got accustomed to it. Got accustomed to discipline in there. In that environment, if you do something wrong, they don't make you write your name on the blackboard 2,700 times. They got a paddle in there that's about 6 inches wide and about 2 foot long, and it's got holes drilled in it, and they stick your underwear to your butt, you know. You grab your ankles and they stick your underwear to your butt. They taught me right there, 12 years old. I learned the difference between mental pain and physical pain, right there. There's a big difference. And I found that out right there. But I also found out that you could put a tube of airplane glue in a paper bag and stick your head in there and have some guy hold the bag around your neck, and you could breathe in and breathe out until you couldn't stand yourself no more, and you'd get high and fiddle around, and then you didn't care whether your underwear was stuck to your rear or not. You know? Had the same effect on me. You know? I found out in there that you could take some of those inhalers. Years ago, they used to have those inhalers, and you could bust that inhaler, and it had benzedrine or dexedrine in the cotton, and you'd chop that cotton up in little pieces and swallow it. You had to throw it up after a period of time because that cotton would swell up and constipate you for 2 weeks. Timing was real important. I learned that. But I was thinking about when I was looking at my second step, I was thinking, I'm locked up. I can't go anywhere. I'm in a room at least 12 hours a day with people just like me. The rest of the time, I'm still locked up. I'm taking something that's going to keep me up for 3 days because I don't want to miss nothing. You know, I mean, that's alcoholic behavior. I mean, I'm 13 years old and I'm locked up. I mean, nothing changes. Nothing changed in there. It was the same. It was the same in there 4 years later when I got out of there. Nothing had changed other than people grew up, you know, not emotionally necessarily, but I'm in there putting something in me so I can stay awake for 3 days, you know. And I don't know why. It's because it was there. You know, people would ask me all the time, "Why'd you do that?" I don't know why. If I had to stop and think why, I wouldn't want to do it. I wouldn't, you know, I just don't bother with why I did it. And I think that's a certain alcoholic characteristic. Say it's a threefold disease, physical, mental, and spiritual. And the mental part of it was that I didn't care why. It didn't make any difference. And, by the time I was 12, 12 years old, I was locked up in there because, not because I was mentally touched or anything like that necessarily, it's because I was just uncontrollable. I couldn't handle authority, and they put me in that environment, and I functioned. I functioned well scholastically, I functioned well in sports. I actually functioned well in that environment in the sense of I became a mentor for all these little troubled kids. I functioned. I became their mentor. Sometimes I led them in good direction, and sometimes I led them in bad direction. But I became their mentor in 4 years. They looked up to me. Every year in that little reformatory thing, sometime during the course of a year, they would give awards for the best athlete, for the best scholastic person. And there was probably, I don't know, 200-300 young kids in there, guys. And they would give an award for the most popular. Everybody would vote who they liked the best. I won that 4 times. Never was done before or since. 4 times, all those kids voted on me. And there was some, that's pretty stiff competition. And in that environment, it was very, there were some good guys in there. You know, there was some heavy, you know. I was the head sick. You know. But by the same token, you know, I mean, coming from an alcoholic home, a lot of them kids, little kids come from, they didn't know it was an alcoholic home. And I didn't know that, but looking back on it, I understood how they felt. So I had compassion for these kids. That's why they liked me. I had compassion for them. I was ahead of them, and I had a compassion. Now, there's a very significant reason that I tell you that. It's because alcoholics, of my type anyway, end up in Alcoholics Anonymous. By the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had destroyed everything around me. I had destroyed everything. I had destroyed a career. I had destroyed brain cells. I had destroyed marriages. I had destroyed family. I had destroyed friendships. I had destroyed loyalty. I had destroyed my credit. I had destroyed everything around me, and I had nothing. I mean, I think that, you know, in a sense, it's almost necessary to get to that point. We call it a bottom or something. It's important to get to that point in order to say I'm willing to do whatever is necessary to be done. But by the same token, my self-worth was zero. I have nothing. Zero. And I'm so grateful that people had sense enough to, you know, ask me, you know, when I was less than 30 days sober, they said, has there ever been a time in your life whenever you felt like you were worth something? Not a material thing or anything like that, but was there ever a time in your life? I'm 36 years old. I'm sitting in a detox. I owe $250,000. There's two different groups of people got a contract on my life. The lady that I'm presently married to was my third wife, and she's left me. My kid hated me. My dog bit me. My cat scratched me. I had no career. I had nothing. I couldn't even think. I couldn't tell you what happened 2 hours ago. My mind was so scrambled. And I'm sitting in that detox, and Dr. Paul, the guy that's in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, a doctor, addict, alcoholic, Dr. Paul happened to be the head of the detox. And Dr. Paul's sitting there, and he's my doctor, and he don't know me. I don't know him. He just, you know, and he asked me, was there ever a time in your life whenever you felt like your life was worth something? And the only thing I could think of, as scrambled as I was, I remember when I was a kid in that locked up thing, somebody liked me. Those kids liked me. And that's what I told Paul, sitting in that detox. That's all I had. I had a lot of reference points. There was times when I had a couple $100,000 cash in front of me. It wasn't mine, but I had it. There was times when I had everything that you could ever want, materially, scholastically, athletically. I played football for the University of Oklahoma under Bud Wilkerson, and one of the greatest coaches of all time. They had 22 freshman teams, and I played on the third string, fullback. I could run a 100-yard dash faster than anybody there. And drank it up. Drank it up. And the only thing I could go back on was the fact that them guys liked me. Now, isn't that amazing? When I look at that, the honesty of that, and the thread that runs through that, the spiritual thread, what is the one thing that's necessary in order to have continuous sobriety? The one thing that's not people-pleasing, it's working with other people and having compassion. So sitting in there with just a few days of sobriety, looking back at a point in my life when I was 13 years old, 14 years old, 15 years old, locked up, those kids liked me because I had identity with them. Those kids liked me because I could share with them. Those little kids liked me because I could say, I understand where you're at. I had a common bond. I had a common solution. We're locked up. Face it. And they liked me for that. See? 20 years, 25 years later, I'm locked up in a detox, and a guy's asking me, what is it that's important to you? What time in your life you felt like you was worth something? And it was that point. You see? And I remember those things. I think those things for me are very important to remember. Even though I'm sitting there and everything, I've destroyed everything around me, there has to be something in your life that's good. Every alcoholic has something in their life that's good. Every human being has something in their life that's good. They have God-given talents. They have God-given, abilities. If we can sober up and uncover and discover and discard all the crap, why then there's something good. We have to manifest the good. That's the one thing that has been the most important thing for me to understand in order to have continuous sobriety. That's the difference. When I went to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and I went because my wife sent me, because she's, you know, everything's a chaotic situation at my home, I'd go home and drink. Because I'd go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she wouldn't change. So why go? See? When I went to Alcoholics Anonymous because the judge sent me, I'd go and get my little card signed and I'd do all that stuff. And as soon as the card was signed, as soon as that period of time was over, then I would drink. It's like there's a little period here where you have to straighten up and fly right. But as soon as that's over, I would drink. See? As soon as that's over, I would drink. And after you do that so many times, the book talks about the repeaters. It talks about the people that, you know, develop the pattern of going in and out and in and out. And ultimately, I mean, I become a loser. By the time I'd gone in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for 2 years, I was thoroughly convinced that I was sicker than anyone else. Not that I was different. I knew I was powerless over alcohol when I was 12 years old. I took the first part of the first step when I was 12, 13 years old. No problem. See? But I didn't take the second half of that first step. And I had a little problem with the we thing. You know, the strange thing about the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says we admit it. I would always admit this. And see, the bad part about it is that whenever I would admit I'm powerless over alcohol, it was always because I drank and I'd done something and destroyed it. I'd wrecked the car. I'd spent all the money. I'd lost the job. I'm getting divorced again. You know? I beat the house up. I was a house beater, you know. Knock all the windows out of the house. It cost $1,000 to put all the windows back. And it's hard to see anything good in there. And particularly if you hang around with people I hung around with, because when I get drunk and do something like that, the people I hung around with would always tell me how I screwed up. They would always list the long list of things that you've done that you shouldn't do. I always, every time I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, the last part of my drinking, I'd go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd get sober, I'd owe $1,000. I think, man, I can make that $1,000 in no time. I'd make the $1,000, I'd pay it back, I'd get drunk. I'd sober up and I'd owe $3,000. Gee, you know? And I'd paid the $1,000 back, no problem. So I'd work and stay sober. And I'd pay $2,000 of the $3,000 back. Then I'd get drunk. And when I come to, I owed $5,000. Plus the $2,000 that I didn't pay back. Or the $1,000 that I didn't pay back from the last time. And by the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, 36 years old, I owed $250,000 to people. You can't write them a damn letter and say, I'll send you $100 a month, huh? It's real hard to reach down in and get any self-worth. The only self-worth I could get out of that amount of money, and it's still kind of an ego thing. I mean, that's a nice round figure, you know. And I could sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, some guy talk about, well, I don't have any money to buy gas. I said, hell, I owe $250,000, dude. You think yours is bad, you know. I mean, that's all I was getting out of that. You don't get much self-worth out of that. And the worst part about it was I didn't know how I was going to pay it back. See? And I'm hearing all these people talk about, you know, an amends is an amends. If you owe $250,000, the amends is you got to pay $250,000 back. I mean, I couldn't remember what time the meeting started tomorrow. My sponsor had to come and get me and take me to the meeting tomorrow. He didn't say, I'll see you at the meeting tomorrow. My sponsor said, I'll come and get you. Wait. You know? So, I mean, I couldn't even qualify for flipping hamburgers down there, you know, for $6 an hour. I had no clue how I'm going to pay this money back. See? I had no idea how am I going to do this. I just wanted to stay sober. And I had to go back and draw on something in my past that was good. And the only thing I had in my past that was good was the fact that when I was locked up with them other kids, I had compassion for them, I had love for them, I had loyalty to them, I had a fellowship and a camaraderie with them. And they told me at a very early time of my sobriety I was going to have to work with others. So you got to work with others. So the reason you're going to work the steps is not so you get better, because you're so sick that working the steps, nobody will notice the difference. They told me that. They said, you know where it says in the book that no matter how far down the scale you've gone, they said, bud, you are way down. You're off the bottom of that sucker. So don't worry about that. They told me in the very early beginning of my sobriety that for me to work the steps, nobody would know the difference. The only reason that I need to work those steps is because if I work the first 5 steps as soon as possible, it qualified me to receive a 5th step. And the only way I'm going to get better is if I go out there and start working with other drunks. See, when I go in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for 4 years, and when I drank, I had no loyalty with the people I drank with. I'd screw over them. I'd borrow $100 from you, pay you 50 back, never pay you the other 50. I'd steal your money in your own house. We'd be drunk in there, and the next morning we need something, booze, and I got no money except what I stole from you, and I got it rat-holed in my sock. And you get up and start looking for your money, and you know you hit it, and maybe you hit it, and I'd say, you probably hit it. Yeah, I was drunk last night, I probably hit it. And you'd start looking for your money in your house, and I stole it, it's in my sock, and I would help you look for your money. You know, there ain't no real loyalty in that, you know. And so I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't have any morals. The most ridiculous thing that I could think of is to work these steps. They didn't make any sense to me. How are you going to do a fearless inventory? I'm riddled with fear. I'm absolutely riddled with fear. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that once you sober up, then a lot of these things invert. Like me, I'm a violent person. And physically violent. The accelerator of that fear, I drink and I become violent. I act on it. When I sober up, that goes inverse. It goes inward. And I can't act on the violence, and when I sober up, then it goes inward. And it becomes just like battery acid to me. See? And I would hate me, and I would loathe me. And I would just turn inside out. I'd sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and I'd hear you talk about the good things that happen in your life. And I'd say, that's fine for you, Hoss, but it ain't going to happen for me. And the physical part of that violent situation, when it goes inward, it's not only a depression, it's just hate inward. And the physical craving, the phenomena of craving with that kind of hate, inward self-hate, self-loathing, it gives you a metallic taste in your mouth. And I'd sit there in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't the mental thing. It was the phenomena of craving inside of me. And I'd sit there and I just couldn't stand that hate. And so I'd go drink because the taste part of that thing. And whenever I'd put the booze in there, it'd go, ah. See? And then I couldn't help anybody. I couldn't do anything with anybody. See? So I couldn't stay sober. I'd get drunk and go home and go to AA and stay sober a few days and go home and nothing was happening in my house. Nothing was changing in my house because my wife wasn't going to Al-Anon. Nothing was happening. I'd go home right back into the same stupid, crazy environment. And my wife would get on my case and she'd get right up in my face. And I'd say, get out of my face or I'm going to hit you. And she'd take one step closer. And I'd say, if you don't get out of my face, I'm going to hit you. And she'd take one step closer. And then I'd hit her. I'd just been to an AA meeting, for God's sakes. See? And then the fight's on. Boom. Then I'm drunk. See? The same pattern over and over again. I can't stay sober in an environment that I drank in. The same me will always drink again. And I don't know how to change me. That was one of the most frustrating things there was about going to Alcoholics Anonymous, is because I'm going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I get sober. Because I'd go to AA meetings and I'd get some sobriety, but I'd go back into that insane environment. I'd go back in there doing the deals, trying to make money, trying to hustle, kiting them checks all over town, 6, 7, 8 bank accounts, flying paper everywhere. See? And I'd go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I'd sit in there and the guilt would be overwhelming, the realization is overwhelming, and the self-loathing and the hate went inside of me, and I'd just get up in the middle of an AA meeting, go out and get drunk. Come back, pick up my court card, you know, drunk. I could not understand why I couldn't stay sober, the most frustrating thing I ever had. You know, and it not only baffled me, it baffled my wife, it baffled my kid, it baffled the preacher, it baffled the neighbors, it baffled the family. Meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was still drinking. I go to one of them things where they have meetings 24 hours a day, get drunk and sober 4 times, sitting right in AA. You know? Just riddled with hate and all that stuff. I'd sober up and it'd just go inward. Just go inward. And I ended up in that detox, and I'm not one that's going to put detoxes down. I'm grateful for the detox because the detox, they kept me locked up long enough for me to understand that I had a disease for the first time in my life. You see, always before, people would treat me, if I was stealing, people would treat me for my stealing. And I wouldn't be honest with them and tell them the reason I'm stealing is because I need to get drunk. I'm stealing the money so I can get drunk. They never treated it as alcoholism. They always treated the stealing. They always treated the lying. They always treated some other thing that we would divert it to, not the alcohol or the drugs. I ended up in a detox, and I sobered up. And they explained to me that I had the disease of alcoholism, a threefold nature, physical, mental, and spiritual. They told me that I had a phenomenon of craving. And I said, I don't understand that. I mean, I understand it, but I don't understand it. And they explained to me it's very important to remember that phenomenon of craving because the animal's in the cage and the door isn't locked. They explained to me that many times I did things to my family, to my loved ones, and to people, and was irresponsible because I still had the alcohol in me or the narcotics in me, and the phenomenon of craving wasn't dead, and that I would drink again knowing that what I was doing was wrong over and over and over again. Even though morally I knew it was wrong, even though I had guilt, I knew what I was doing was wrong. And I would do it over and over and over again. I would repeat it over and over again. And it was baffling to me why I would do it over and over again, and what it was the phenomenon of craving. I would set up that phenomena of craving. I'd get a certain amount of sobriety of the phenomena of craving and make me thirsty, and I'd drink. And once I could accept that, I could start forgiving myself a little bit. And once I could get a little bit of forgiveness, I could start working, you know, a program. I was standing around the old Anaheim Alano Club down in Anaheim, California, and they took me to those Alano Clubs. Because I could sit in that Alano Club and I'd look around and stuff on the walls and everything else in there. I mean, if you ain't an alcoholic, you ain't sitting in an Alano Club. You know? And I had to maintain that constant thought that I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic. And they railroaded me into being the secretary of a meeting there. I had hair down to my rear. I had a beard down to my navel. I didn't wear underwear. I didn't wear socks. I didn't do anything. I traveled light. I had so many guns on me that if you'd have bumped into me, there'd have been a mushroom cloud. I carried guns in my boots. I was a little bit paranoid, to tell you the truth. They made me secretary of the meeting. I'd worked the steps. I'd done everything, you know, and nothing had changed. Just working the steps. I buzzed right through the steps, no problem. That's not a big intellectual thing, buzzed through the steps. And said, okay, I'll let my character defects hit me. Come on. Come on, character defects. Let's work on them. You know, and boy, did they bloom. I was trying to make my amends. I was trying to pay this money back. There were some absolutes. The part of the change in me that I knew on May 11, 1976 is just as absolute for me today as it was on that first day of sobriety. Something I'd never done before in the 4 years I'd gone in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't cheat on my wife. I always cheated on my wife. I mean, we'd get in those fights and everything. You know, I look back on that today. A lot of that stuff that was going on back then was that I was drinking and using so much that it was destroying my ability to function as a man. And as that part of me was failing, then I would start the fights with my wife, and then I would leave the house and go get a hooker, you know, because I couldn't perform at home. I had to leave home because the disease was so terrible in our home that when I couldn't perform, function as a man, I had to criticize her as a woman, then she'd have to criticize me as a man, and I'd have to run out there and go hire some woman, see, and somebody that didn't know, somebody that couldn't tell the truth about my impotency, see. That's failing in me. That nurtured the anger inside of me. And I knew whenever I sobered up and came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I can't do that. I can't play those games and stay sober. For me to do that is a drink. Same thing with the checking accounts. I had to close the checking account. And I couldn't kite paper all over. I was kiting paper everywhere. And I haven't cheated on my wife, and I haven't written any hot checks in over 21 years. And I haven't hit anybody in over 21 years. The physical violence had to stop. It had to be just as absolute as the alcohol. Because there was a pattern there. As soon as there was physical violence, and it would propagate itself. One of my biggest fears was that I was a rager. And I would rage, and as that rage came, well, then it just took physical action. There was no conscious thought. And one of the things where it scared me the most was when I was going in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd set that rage up, and then boom, something would happen, and then I'd be struck with a drink in my hand. And then I'd drink it. And one of my biggest fears in sobriety was that I'd get so blind rage that I couldn't define what was going to happen. My biggest fear was no matter how drunk I am, how sober I am and how much I want to stay sober, if I let that rage go, then I'm going to just end up with this in my hand. Of course, if you're hanging around a place where you can ventilate your rage, well, there's booze around there. And somebody, they would always say, you're crazy. Take a drink. See? And I go to an AA meeting, go down there and fight with my wife, go down to the bar, pick a fight with you, and somebody say, calm down, take a drink. I'd be drunk. Behind that same thing. So all that physical violence and all that rage had to stop. That's just as absolute today as the alcohol and the narcotics. And those absolutes, you know, they weren't something that I had to write a long inventory about. I'd been getting drunk and sober, drunk and sober, and drunk and sober with those patterns. And so I go work a fourth and fifth step with somebody, a sponsor, and then my sponsor sent me this goofy guy and said, work with him, you know? And I would sit there and I'd listen to people tell me how they go home and start to fight with their wife and then they get drunk. And I'd say, yeah, it happens to you too. See? I'd hear some guy, you know, talk about going down on Harbor Boulevard and picking up a hooker, and then next thing you know, he's had 6 months of sobriety and he's struck drunk. And I said, yeah, you too. See? And I would hear all these guys tell me in their fifth steps and trying to work with them with the steps, I would hear the consequences of their action over and over and over again. See? And I remember my sponsor telling me, he said, that's the reason you got to work with newcomers. Irregardless of how long you're sober, You got to work with newcomers. You got to hear people over and over and over again tell you the consequences of their actions so that you have a choice. Listening to Fifth Steps just literally gave me a conscience. I would listen to people, when, I mean new, 6 months, 8 months. And I would listen to guys who were slipping in and out. I would go into penitentiaries. I started going into penitentiaries on panels when I lied and said I had 6 months, and I was going in there 4 months. And I listened to the repeaters in there. I would sit in a meeting, and I would listen to them, and a guy would say, I got out, and the first thing I had to do is get a woman, get drunk, and now I'm back in here. And I would listen to that. That's why my sponsor said, that's why you go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, so you can hear the consequences of the action, so that you can see what's happening. And I would listen to that. See? My wife started going to Al-Anon. My kids started going to Alateen. And, I laugh about that. I can tell you some funny little stories about that, but I'll tell you what, I couldn't go back into that environment. See, I couldn't go back into that environment. My daughter was so beat down by the disease of alcoholism that she'd put her cat in the dryer and spin it for a second or two, 15 seconds, and then open the door on that dryer, and the cat would jump out and cling to her. And that was my daughter at 13 years old's interpretation of love. That hostage, clinging, fear, feeling. See? That's the way everybody in that house interpreted love. See? That clinging, holding on to each other. I remember the first time I went to see that movie, Runaway Train, with John Voight. And they're on that engine up there, and the guy's trying to jump, and he can't make it, and they come back in, and he beats the hell out of him, and John Voight and that kid and that penitentiary and that girl are all huddled up in there. They fight with each other, and then they huddle up in there, and they covet each other. See, and that's the way my whole family was. See, nurture that pain. I hate you, but we're all we've got. See? And that had to change. That had to change in order for me to have sobriety. That had to change in order for my family to have any recovery. There had to be change. And I could not understand how in the heck you can work the steps and anything's going to change from this. See? I would try to work the steps and I didn't see any immediate change. I'd try to work the steps and I'd go look at the mirror and I'd look for some kind of a physical change. And I had 3 or 4 different costumes. I'd get up early in the morning and I decided to go to a morning meeting, and I'd think, well, who am I? Well, I'm from Texas. I'd go out and put on my Levi's, my boots, my vest, and my cowboy hat, and do a couple of, shit howdies in the mirror, and my wife would run over and call her Al-Anon sponsor and get on the phone, and I'd go out and kiss her goodbye and go out and get my pickup and take off for the meeting, and I'd get down there about a block or two from the meeting, and I'd think, nah, I'm not a cowboy today, and I'd turn around and I'd come back home and I'd take off my cowboy stuff, and I think, well, no, I'm a biker today. So I'd take off that and I'd put on all my leathers and I'd put my bandana on and I'd get in front of the mirror and do a couple of rib ups and go out and kiss her goodbye and go out in the garage and fire my Harley up and ride it down there and get a mile or two from the meeting and think, no, I'm kind of a marshmallow today. And I'd turn around and go home, park the bike, take the leathers off, go in, put on a 3-piece suit, get the dictionary out, look up some $75 words in that dictionary. Because you're going to wear a 3-piece suit to an early morning meeting, you need to talk some big words, and I just recite a few big words, go out and kiss her goodbye, go out and get my big AA car, head for the meeting, get a block from the meeting, forget the big words, you can't wear a 3-piece suit in there if you can't talk. So I go in there and take off my 3-piece suit, put on my sweats, and go out and kiss her goodbye, and jog to the meeting, And I remember one time my wife's sponsor said, how many people live in that house, So I just won. The alcoholic just got it. You don't know who he is today, but he's got it down to 4, I remember running down to that meeting. I run in that meeting. I'm all sweaty, and I got my sweats on. Sit down next to an old-timer, and he said, oh, jogging, huh? And I said, yeah. He said, I'd rather work the steps myself. I hated him, Because I'm working the steps. If I hadn't been working the steps, I couldn't have got down to 4, I had so much stuff, it's an amazing thing. They say more will be revealed, and I had so many things. I'm grateful that God in His infinite wisdom and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is designed so that more will be revealed.
I think one of the most important things about my fourth step, my initial fourth step, was the fact that a lot of the fantasies left, and it left truth. But the worst thing about the fifth step was that the truth was the truth. And then the good thing about that is the truth will set you free, but then what are you going to do with it? You know? The character defect 6 and 7 says, you know, this is a step that separates the men from the boys, but there's some things here that I enjoy and I really don't want to change. And so I pray for the willingness. And that's all I could do. I'm so grateful for those kind of loopholes in the steps, you know, if you will. And I'm grateful that what happened was that as things were, I remember a newcomer came into my house and I let him in and he was going to work the steps and he couldn't write. He couldn't read and he couldn't write. And he's sitting in my kitchen and he's talking. He conned me into writing his fourth step. The way God works in my life is that you just got to be willing. When it says just be willing to do whatever is necessary to be done. It's absolutely amazing to me what has happened in my life because of that willingness. I'm sitting in my kitchen and this guy's calling me into writing his fourth step and he's talking. In the middle of his fourth step, he said, "Do you ever do anything like that?" And I said, "Yeah, I did something like that." And I would start telling him, and since I was writing his stuff without even thinking, I'm writing my stuff. And then it dawned on me that I've unloaded some stuff. And it's specifically stuff that I'd forgot about. That I'd shoved down so deep. And here it is, the truth. And it's right there with his stuff. And I didn't sit there that day and explain to him what had happened. I had an overwhelming good feeling that what had happened is that we had done some more uncovering, discovering, and discarding. We had unloaded my load, and we had unloaded his load. And we shouldn't question that. We should get rid of that and move on. And that's exactly what I did. And it lightened my load. See, it lightened my load. Sitting there. I killed a man in a bar fight. And the family that the guy killed come from a pretty heavy-duty family. A bunch of brothers. And they said they were going to kill me sometime in the next 10 years for that. Vengeance is like a fine wine. It ages with time, they said. During that happened in about 1972, and I sobered up in 76. I still had a few years on that debt, sober. I had so many things going on in my life that little vendetta was just, you know, it was about number 9 on a 10 list, you know. I remember I ran into, I owed a guy over in Whittier a bunch of money and I owed him, you know, some favors. I was supposed to deliver some dope and I stole it and I kept whining to my sponsor. He didn't know nothing about that kind of stuff, you know. And finally one day I was sitting in a meeting, you know, after a meeting and I'm whining to my sponsor and I said, "That guy over in Whittier is going to kill me and I can't hear nothing in AA meeting because I'm thinking about that guy killing me." And my sponsor says, "Get up off your rear and go over there, Whittier, and tell him you're going to make it right." "You don't even have a clue what I'm talking about, man. This guy's got guns by the door, underneath the tables. He's got guns on him. He don't think nothing about shooting people. You want me to go over there, stone cold sober, walk up to his door, knock on that door, and say, 'I'm an AA now. I'm going to make it right. I can't steal. I can't lie. I can't use. I can't do nothing. But don't worry. I'm going to make it right.'" I mean, that's what I thought when my sponsor said. I didn't say that. I got up off that bench and I went over and got in my pickup truck. I drove over to Whittier. I said the Serenity Prayer over and over and over and over and over and over again. And I pulled up in front of his house. I jumped out. I ran up to the door, knocked on the door. He came to the door. He looked at me and I looked at him. My eyes must have been that big around. And I said, "I'm an AA. I'll make it right." He said, "Ha! What are you doing here? I'm going to kill you." I said, "Don't kill me. I'll make it right." I turned around and I ran back down to my pickup truck. I got in my truck. I drove right back over there to that Alano Club. My sponsor was still sitting there on the bench talking to a guy. I come in there and said, "I'm hyperventilating. I'm sweating. I'm crazy." And my sponsor said, "I thought I told you to go to Whittier." I said, "I did." He said, "And he didn't kill you?" I said, "No." He said, "I'll be damned." You know? He said, "I got a couple of deals. Maybe I ought to try like that." You know what I mean? You know, I knew he'd tried that on me, and if it worked, he'd try it himself. I knew that. And I was willing to be the guinea pig. Yeah. I also know that sponsorship in that area is very, very important, because there's a part in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and in the steps that imply that our enemies will welcome us. It says something like that. Our enemies will welcome us. Be careful how you interpret that. Because we come in here, we get sober, and we have all this overwhelming guilt and all this stuff going on, and we run in there willing to, you know, do anything. I'll make it right. And boy, do they take advantage of you. Because they ain't got no recovery. And I had some pretty heavy hits coming from that. That damn near destroyed me. You see, I believe that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I sobered up, and they told me if I wanted to stay sober when all else fails. Isn't that an amazing thing? It says, when all else fails, work with another alcoholic. That must mean that they knew that all else has to fail. And then when there's nothing left, you work with another alcoholic. So I'm grateful for the old timers that in my early sobriety, they let all else fail. And then they said, go work with another alcoholic. And I was working with these alcoholics, taking them to meetings, listening to them, and practicing on them. I'm grateful that I had that going on in my life, because I didn't know how to fix my family. And I wanted to fix my family. One of the strangest things that I see is that alcoholic will get in here and they'll work the steps up to the amends step, and it seems to me like a lot of the alcoholics that I see, the first amends they want to make, they'll make the list, and the first amends they want to make is the ninth step is the family. The reason they want to make amends to the family, Al-Anons do the same thing, because the family's blood and they forgive you easier. And so it's a path of least resistance. So run right out there, make amends to mom and dad. In case AA don't work, well, you can come home. You know, in case you need any money and they won't give it to you over at the club, well, you can go back home and get some money. And so it's easier to run right in there and make that amends to the family. And there's an amazing thing that a lot of people do. As soon as they get that amends made to the family, they don't do anything else. See? And my family was so messed up that I didn't have a clue way to do it. I had to take care of all my other amends before my family. I owed my dad money. My dad was the last person I made amends to. And that was money. And I gave him a check when I was 12 years sober. And he looked at it and said, is this any good? 12 years sober. He didn't trust me. Yeah. I mean, I'd screwed over him for 30 years. Why should he trust me in 12? You know? And I had to see those things. And I'm grateful that my wife went to Al-Anon, because I had to pay that $250,000 back with interest. Now the only good news about that is that my wife, not one time has she ever, over 21 years, resented the method of my recovery because of the program of Al-Anon. She allowed me to make those amends. She didn't say we don't have food on the table because you're making those damn amends. She never once said the kids don't have no clothes because you're making those damn amends. She, by that time, had recognized that every time I got drunk, I owed another $1,000. Every time I got drunk or loaded, I owed another $2,000. She had recognized that I bought a house for her, and she lived in it. We lived in it for 10, 12 years. I bought it for $12,000. When I sobered up in May of 1976, I owed $89,000 on that house. And all of that was to Aetna Finance and all them kind of bondsmen and everything, see? I owed $89,000 on that house. She'd seen that, see? Something had to change. It had to change. And I couldn't fix my family and then come to AA and say, everything's fine. Now I'm ready to work with newcomers. I had to work with newcomers first, and I still have to work with newcomers. And then my family's okay. See? And I am so grateful that the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, when I came, they'd seen me going in and out and in and out and in and out, and they didn't come up and say, work the steps and you'll be okay. They'd already shoved that act on me. They didn't say, get a sponsor and everything will be okay. We'd already done that and I got drunk. They didn't say, get a home group and everything will be okay. We'd already done that and I got drunk. The one thing I'd never done in the 4 years I was going in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous was try to give it away. I was so selfish, self-centered, self-seeking, I didn't want to give nothing away. What I wanted to do is get sober, get the heat off, and then get out of my way. And on May the 11th, 1976, they said, what you need to do is work with others. Why don't you try something you haven't tried? And they shoved a goof on me and said, you know, help him. I don't know, 36, 37 days sober, and this guy was on antabuse. And he drank on antabuse. He found out you could take all these antihistamines and it would counteract the antabuse. And then, you know, he took 100 Sudafed and Contact or something and you know, and then he's drunk and he's over there, he's got a gun and he's going to commit suicide. And he called me up. So I go over there, I'm going to help him. The only problem was I couldn't get myself positioned right so that if when the gun went off and blew his brains out, it wouldn't get mess on me. And I got frustrated after trying to help him a couple of times and called my sponsor, you know, maybe I should call my sponsor and ask him how to kill this guy, you know. And my sponsor said, get out of there. And I started doing those things with other alcoholics. And that hasn't changed. That has not changed. The amazing thing about it is that when I started giving this thing away and I started working with drunks, I've listened to over 500 fifth steps. I listened to 4 fifth steps last Sunday. Now that's an all-day commitment. When the Green Bay Packers are playing, whatever, you know, when Denver's playing, when Denver's winning again. Now, I listened to 4 fifth step, and I didn't sponsor one of the guys that I listened to fifth step. Because in my home group, I looked around and there was 4 guys in there that were sitting on 4 steps or wouldn't move on that 4 step. And I told them on Thursday night, I want you to have something done on Sunday, and I'll listen to your fifth step. I'm not even their sponsor. 2 of the guys in there, their sponsors working 7-12, construction shut down, and couldn't do it. And I told those guys, I'll do it. I'll make a commitment to you. And I spent all day with 4 guys listening to fifth step and burnt their paper and prayed with them, got on my hands and my knees. I'm 21 and a half years sober. See? And every one of those guys sat there and had all those resentments and all those excuses and everything on paper over and over and over again. The same thing I had when I was in the very beginning. They go home and fight with her, go out and get a hooker. They go home and fight with her and go spend money. They go get drunk and then they go blow money. They go get drunk and they go wreck a car. They go get drunk and they get another woman pregnant. 4 of those guys there got something like 12 kids and they don't even remember having sex with anybody, you know. And they're sitting there stone cold sober with less than 90 days sobriety, all 4 of them, and they're looking at $1,600 to $1,800 a month in child support. And they don't even want to be a father. And they don't understand how in the hell you're going to have any money to live on in sobriety when you're looking at $1,600 a month in child support. How am I going to stay sober? And I could see that thought right there because I'd had that thought before. I might as well get drunk. What the hell? And what I tried to feed them was a little bit of self-worth. A little bit of self-worth. And I said, was there ever a time in your life when something good was going on? Was there ever a time in your life when you could look back and you amounted to something, when somebody said you're all right? Reach back and get that little thing in your life somewhere back there. Irregardless of how much denial you have, irregardless of what terrible things are going on in your life or did go on in your life, irregardless of what you want to hold on to in your life that you did because of the disease of alcoholism, reach back in there and say, was there ever a time in my life when I was worth something? And if it had anything to do with helping another human being, you got a beachhead right there. You got something to hold on to. Because the only thing that I know to do today is help another alcoholic. Help another alcoholic. An amazing thing. When I've been helping another alcoholic, an amazing thing has happened. My family came together. My kid loves me and forgiven me. My neighbors accept me as I am. I live in a nice house, drive a nice car, got a good job, got a savings account, got insurance on my car, you know, got a few bucks in my pocket. Got up at 3 o'clock this morning. I go to work early in the morning. I get up 3 o'clock. I don't have to have 4 alarm clocks. I wake up, go to work. I work for my sobriety. I go to work. I got a boss. I got a boss. A woman. A man-hating woman. I love her. I understand. Yes, ma'am. No, ma'am. One of the greatest disciplines that I ever have in my entire sobriety is having a boss. I'll tell you what, I've heard some of the greatest lectures in Alcoholics Anonymous about sponsorship. And I'm going to tell you something. The greatest lecture you can hear about sponsorship is to go get a job, get a boss, and do what you're supposed to do. Do what they tell you to do. do your job. That's the greatest lecture you can have on sponsorship. See? I had no discipline. The book said we're undisciplined people. And I had to put that discipline in. I had to get a job. And the reason I got a job is because I had to work for my sobriety. See? I had to work for my sobriety. And I had a certain amount of self-worth because I was working for my sobriety. I remember the first time I got a job and I wasn't wheeling and stealing anymore and I was going down the street on a Friday and I looked at that paycheck and I thought, you know what? I made more money in 15 seconds out there turning tricks than I did working 40 hours for this stupid check. And I paid over half of it to the government, you know? And I thought, you know what? But it's mine. I don't have to look over my shoulder. The IRS audited me the first 3 years I was sober because they couldn't understand how I have nothing over here and then I'm making money over here, and they couldn't understand all these different things. And then they audited me again, and they've been after me ever since. And I love it when I get audited because it means I'm doing the right thing. I love to pay taxes today because it means I'm working. See? And I remember new sober going down the street, and I had an old Plymouth car, a four-door car, and I had it full of alcoholics, and I'm telling them, you got to get a job. I'm slapping this guy behind, you got to get a job. And I'm telling this other guy over here, you need to get a job, you dumb shit. Get a job. I dropped him off. You need to get a paper and look up and get a job. And I dropped him off, and I'm driving home, and I think, I need to get a job. You can't hardly keep telling six guys to get a job when you don't have a job. You know, you let them out, and they look at you like, what about you? You know? And I got that job. I tell you what, I went to work for a company 12 years ago, and I've been there for 12 years. And when I went to work there, I mean, this is alcoholic mentality. For those of you, if there's any non-alcoholics and you don't understand this, you understand this, but I went to work over there at this company, and they have a savings plan, and I said, take all you can, because I'm going to spend the rest. They just kind of looked at me. I have got to learn how to live on what I get. And I got a thing the other day in the mail, and I got $187,000 in that saving. $187,000. See? Nobody explained that to me. See? I don't need it. But you know what that did to my wife and my kid when I showed my wife that piece of paper? She had a feeling of security. See? You know how many alcoholics? I'll tell you one of the saddest things in Alcoholics Anonymous today. There's a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous today that are sober well over 30 years that have no retirement. They have nothing. They're broke. Broke. Little Social Security, that's it. Nothing. Nothing. They may be a guru down to home group, but they got nothing. That's sad. Because that isn't what Alcoholics Anonymous taught me. And the steps. And telling the newcomer to do things. It taught me to come up out of the gutter. It taught me to treat my wife decent. See? He didn't say it's okay to run around and act like you're drunk. Didn't say that. See, my life gets better as I grow spiritually. It gets better in my conditions in my life. It gets better in the security. The promises talk about those kind of things. One of the saddest things in Alcoholics Anonymous today is that people are running around all depressed because they can't work the steps, they can't do anything, and they're taking Prozac and all kinds of stuff like that. You know, when all they need to do is go get another alcoholic and work with another alcoholic. When all else fails, work with another alcoholic. I'm so grateful that I was taught that. That was given my foundation, the very beginning of my sobriety. It's the most cherished thing there is. Everything about my program is foundation around newcomers. I believe for me that if I'm out of here doing this, and I've been going around talking for probably 18 years. There was a few years there where I went 52 weeks. One year I talked in every state in the union. Because my wife's involved with Al-Anon, and we'd be asked to speak at Al-Anon convention. And so it wasn't a problem for me to speak at a... You want to know how I was doing? I whipped my calendar out and said, look at this, Hoss. I don't have time to talk to you. Look where I'm speaking next week. Then I found myself looking in there to see what I'm speaking Friday night, Saturday night, or Sunday so I can plan my talk. That's heady wine. That's drunken behavior. And I sat down and I did an inventory on that. How did I get here? How did I get to that point in my life? I believe for every year that I'm sober, I should sponsor somebody. If I'm running around out here doing these things, there ought to be somebody somewhere in my home group somewhere that would say, I want what you got. Will you teach me how to get it? And that's just my barometer. Everybody has their own barometer. But I sponsor 24 people, actively sponsor them, talk to them. But when I was crazy running around doing that stuff, I'll tell you what I was doing. I looked at the people I sponsored, and they were all sober over 5 years. There was 15 of them that were in 8, 9, 10 years sober. I was only sponsoring people with time. Because there's a certain complacency that you can fall into if all you sponsor is people with time. I wasn't working with newcomers anymore. And I had to come back and get down in the trench, and I had to say no to some of those commitments, and I had to say, I gotta put my home group first, and I gotta come back to the trench, and I gotta come back and work with them newcomers. And now I keep a balance. I pay attention to these things. This isn't some, well, if you count how many people you sponsor, that's ego. No, it's a part of the tools of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that enhances my sobriety. And a third of the people I sponsor are sober over 10 years, and a third of the people I sponsor are sober somewhere between 3 and 8 years sober, and a third of the people I sponsor are under 2 years sober, all the way down to days. And I keep it that way because I was taught in the very beginning to give this thing to work with other drunks. Work with other drunks so that I'm talking to a guy. I got to sponsor a guy right now that's 20 years sober that was a millionaire in a year. He quit talking to me, quit going to meetings. He sponsored 27 people. He quit sponsoring the people, and he's broke today. Broke. Lost everything. 20 years sober. And the guy he sponsored was a multimillionaire, and the guy he sponsored was right there with him, and he lost $3 million at the window at the track. And he's broke. He not only took himself to that point, he took a guy he sponsors to that point. Now he's calling me up saying, what do I do? I said, well, when all else fails, you might ought to go get you a newcomer and work with a newcomer. Because I remember your ass when you're sitting in a Lana Club begging for $10 so you could get lunch today. And you're there again. See? That's what I've come to understand about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not who's right, it's who's left that counts. See? I don't want to die loaded. I've been here long enough that I've seen a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous who've worked fantastic programs of Alcoholics Anonymous, my peers, my mentors. And because of the chaos in their life, they end up with some kind of physical condition that makes it necessary for them to take narcotics the last year or two of their life. I've seen so many of them in the last year or two. And even though people in Alcoholics Anonymous have a tendency to give these people credit for their long-term sobriety, they ain't sober. They're loaded. They didn't die sober. They died loaded. Loaded because of the hate and the loathing and the drunken behavior and sobriety takes them back to that point. I would hate to think that I've worked as hard as I have to stay sober, that my attitude is going to cause me to die loaded. I would hate to think that. But by the same token, there's a responsibility in that. There's a responsibility. Every morning I wake up next to a lady I love very much. We've been together 37 years. She knows me better than I know myself. Her and I have gone all over the United States and other countries talking about the good things that happened in our life as a result of this program. My daughter's 35 years old. My daughter's 21 and a half years in this program. My wife and my daughter and I have gone all over. There's tapes all over of my wife and my daughter talking about the good things that have happened in our life, the recovery, the hope, the healing that's happened in my family. There's been people, countless people, come up to me and say, you know, your tape saved my life. There's been people whose families have absolutely no hope, mother, father, children, have come up to me and said, you know, I listened to the tape of you and your wife and your kid. And it gave me hope. It gave me something to hold on to. Now that isn't feeding my ego. I'll tell you what that is. That's a responsibility for me to stay sober. That when I want to say, screw it, I don't want to do this, or whenever somebody wants to talk crap, I got to turn my back and go the other way. When I got to get up at 3 o'clock and go to work, and when I got to get up this morning at 3 o'clock and go to work, and then from there go to the airport and then fly over here and then get these jerks and they come and get me and take me to the hotel and throw me in there and hurry up, God, we got to get over to this meeting, and you come over to the meeting and here you are, and I got to bear my soul to you. You know why I do that? Because I want to wake up. And I want to know everything's all right. I want to have that feeling about that woman and that kid. I want the people that believe in me to continue to believe in me. I'm willing to do these things so that isn't a lie. So that what I said we're doing isn't a lie. How sad that people can come and stay sober and work the steps of this program and put their life together and have people believe in them. And then because of their own selfish and self-centeredness and their own inability to do the things that they had to do in the very beginning of their sobriety, destroys everything in their life and the people, the newcomers that believed in them. What about the newcomers that believed in them? What about the newcomers that hung their hat on that? That said, if you can do it, I can do it. What about them? See, that's what I was taught. I was taught in the very beginning. You know, what you do speaks so loud I can't hear a word you say. I was taught that in the very beginning. And I'm a living example of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not how I dress. Not how I shave. Not where I work. Not what I drive. Not where I live. It's what kind of a member of Alcoholics Anonymous are you? Are you working with newcomers? The greatest compliment I've ever had in Alcoholics Anonymous, bar none. Bar none. Somebody, somewhere, was running a convention, and they went up to an old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they asked this old-timer, I've been thinking about asking this guy, Keith Drum, to come and talk. You know him? And the lady said, yeah, I know him. Do you think I ought to ask him to come and talk? And the lady said, I'll tell you something about Keith Drum. He works with drunks. He's always got newcomers with him. He's always working with drunks. The greatest compliment you could have. And the reason I know that is because in that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, God, make me what you want me to be. What you want me to be. And what my God wants me to be is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous to work with drunks. When I work with drunks, carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and not tell you how to do it, but walk with you when you do it, then my life's good. It's not what you think of me that sets my heart at peace. It's what I think of me that sets my heart at peace. And I know I'm doing right when I'm carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous in the trench with a newcomer. And I hope you never forget that. It's so easy, and I fall into it, to come to deals like this and get up here, and I can give you a little banquet talk. I can give you a little deal, and we can all laugh about going to Al-Anon, Al-Teen, Al-Cat, and Al-Dog, and we can tell you funny stories about that stuff. We can have a laugh. But the important thing to me today is remember where I come from and my teachings, and to carry that message to you. And I hope you remember that. If nothing else, I hope you remember that. One drunk talking to another drunk. And that's all it's about. Thank you.